My name is Tracy Bauer, and you're listening to GradCast, brought to you by Syracuse University. In our episode today, I spoke with Greg Victory, who is an alumnus of Syracuse University's Higher Education Master's Degree Program and a former coworker at Syracuse University holding many different titles. Now, Greg is currently located in Duke at the Career Center there as the Fannie Mitchell Executive Director. And Greg is really passionate about leadership. So he was the person who really came to mind to talk a little bit more about what makes a great leader, how you can hone your leadership skills, as well as how you can translate those skills, especially as a doctoral student from the academy into the industry. I hope you enjoy my conversation with Greg.
Greg Victory. I currently serve as the Fannie Mitchell Executive Director of the Duke Career Center and an Assistant Vice President of Student Affairs. I've been at Duke about a little over 18 months, but I'm a proud CUSE alum, graduate alum from the higher education program in 2004, and a former Syracuse University employee. My first job at Syracuse was in the Career Center, and then I returned after a stint at Colgate to oversee the what was then known as the Office of First Year and Transfer Program. So delighted to be with you today and excited to have this conversation.
I should know I can see you and we're chatting up and down the East Coast today and you're wearing a blue tie. So I know you still bleed orange, but we know you've got to also bleed a little bit of that Duke blue.
Yeah. So, Blue Devils, particularly when Syracuse plays here, I have to wear my Syracuse orange T-shirt underneath my Duke pullover. You know, you got to represent the folks that are writing your paycheck.
There you go. Okay. So Greg, I know that you do a lot with leadership and you've got this amazing last name, Victory. So you have your consulting company, right? Leading to Victory. And so can you talk to me a little bit about leadership and what it means to you?
Sure. So, I have some pretty strong opinions about this word. I honestly think it's been overutilized for many, many years, and particularly working in higher education and working with undergraduate and graduate students. It still sort of, for many folks, tends to be a collection of titles. I have seen this proliferation of co-president, co-leader, co-coordinator, whatever it is. And it's when you talk to folks about, well, what does that really mean? They can't get to the core of what leadership really is, right? And I think one of my favorite descriptions and definitions of leadership, and this is paraphrasing it, is really about, it's a process of social influence, right? Like, how do I maximize the efforts of those around me for us to achieve a common goal? That doesn't mean I'm most in charge. That doesn't mean I have at the top of the hierarchy, I have the most important title. That doesn't mean I have particular personality traits or attributes that define what that really means. It means that in certain moments, I can see the value and skill and competencies of those around me, and I can motivate and get them excited about us moving towards a common goal. I'll say in my career that I define myself as a leader because not because of the positions I've held or the titles that I've had, but because I'm often asked or recruited to apply for positions because of the success I've had at other institutions about sort of getting people excited about a vision, getting them sort of rowing in the same direction, being able to sort of see what their values are as members of that team and amplify those values, and then leaving the institution, I hope, or the organization better than I found it, right? That's not about, I could do that sort of at any level within the organization, and you can do that at any level of the organization. I think for me, what has been valuable is folks have seen that trait, folks have seen that skill set, they've seen that history, and they say, we want you to do that at a larger scope, like at a larger scale. So that's part of, I think, where I've landed in higher education institutions is not because, hey, it's a leadership role, but because I have a set of skills that allow me to have an impact. And the role and the position is really about the scalability of that sort of impact, right? It's, you know, I believe you're not born this way. I believe you don't have to be the best public speaker. You know, I think we point to leaders all the time. I think it was in 2016 that Inc. magazine did, which I'm a huge fan of that magazine, which did sort of an article called 100 Answers to the Question, What is Leadership? And there's more than 100, but they listed 100 different quotes about what people say defines leadership, right? So it's all over the place. But to me, the core is, can you see the value in the people around you? Can you get them excited about moving towards a mission? And can you support them in that particular process? The one thing I will say to you is, if you look at that Inc. list, it is very white male dominated in the responses. So my hope is that they redo that list and diversify the definitions and the folks' voices who are being amplified in those types of places. But for me, it's really about that. And I think I always, when I talk to parents at sort of new student programs, I always say it's their fault that we've talked about leadership in this way, because they signed all their kids up for T-ball. And everybody wins in T-ball, and everybody gets a medal in T-ball. So that's really not what leadership is. And I did a workshop once at a leadership conference called Leadership. You're a Leader, So What? And it's really about, how do you tell the story and how do you give examples of where you've demonstrated leadership qualities and where you've sort of supported those around you. So some folks refer to that, right, as servant leadership. You know, you can sort of call it whatever you want, but it's really about, you know, amplifying the skill sets of those around you to make things better.
I love that definition, because I do think the constant message that a lot of us receive is that you are born a leader or not. And leaders are, we can only have so many leaders, but what you're talking about with your definition is really more in that moment, right? Someone stepping up to take lead on something. It doesn't have to be in your title or just something specific. It can be something you feel excited about and want to generate those resources to work towards. So I think that's a really great definition. And it's something that employers want. Obviously, it's one of the NACE 8 career readiness competencies. And that's why we're talking about it today, because regardless of if you're a communications student or you're over at Maxwell or you're in, you know, architecture, engineering, whatever it is, employers want you to be a leader. But of course, when you first start out, you aren't necessarily in a title with leadership in it. So can you talk to us a little bit about how can someone develop leadership skills throughout their undergrad and graduate programs, and how they can gain those skills and kind of see what type of leader they are and how to demonstrate that to an employer?
Yeah, I mean, part of it is, can you think about times in your own experience where you've demonstrated empathy, right? And empathy is really sort of understanding the needs of those around you. Can you think of a time where you made a decision that actually was primarily focused on helping others and not helping yourself? You know, my challenge again with leadership is it's often in service to me, the way we're describing it. So I'm doing something because it's good for me versus I'm doing something because it's better for those around me. So, you know, are you working on a project in your lab or as a research group where you actually have realized that the direction you're taking is counter to what you want to accomplish? And how do you find your voice and say, I think we're missing something here, or that my lab partner or my colleague actually found a piece of data that changes the outcome of what our initial hypothesis was, right? Or, you know, you're in a situation where you have an opportunity to support work that's going on somewhere else. So you have a summer internship and you're working with a nonprofit and you realize that there's things happening in that nonprofit that aren't allowing it to be as effective or efficient as you want it to be or they want it to be. How do you have what is a tough, often tough conversation with the leadership of that organization, right? Leadership with, I'm doing air quotes, you can't see them, but leadership in air quotes, right? The folks who manage that organization, about ways to help move them in a direction that makes them more effective, right? Often being a leader is about being comfortable in uncomfortable situations, but using data, right? Like using information, using the emotions you see around you, with the ultimate goal being about the benefit of others. you can do that in an internship setting. You can do that in a research setting. You can do that with your own sort of research. You can do that in a class, right? You're on a class project. And this always happens, right? I think all of us have had an experience. I don't know a lot of people that actually will raise their hand and say, I love group work. I would always like to do group work.
Yes.
I mean, I think there are a few people, but very few. But in a group setting, how often are decisions made by the person who has the loudest voice on that team? Right? They're the person who's the first one that raises their hand that says, I'll be the lead, and I'll do the presentation, right? That's often coming from the belief of that makes them better and sort of, for lack of a better term, sort of stepping above the team for their own benefit. Have you ever been in a situation where in that group, one of your more maybe introverted colleagues has actually the best idea, but doesn't have the confidence in that moment or the ability to sort of speak up? And how do you support them? Not necessarily how do you speak for them, but how do you support them and say, that's a really great idea. I agree with you. I think you should say it. And how does that then change the trajectory of that project, right? Does it have a greater impact? Do you do better work? Because it's the person whose voice sometimes gets silenced because of the noise that's going on around that you've sort of said, you know, and it's not your sort of the person who says, I decide what every good idea is, but that you saw value in their idea and you thought it was worth helping amplify that to the rest of the group. So those are the types of experiences. I think being a leader is also being about how do you make a compelling argument, right? How do you do that in a way that's not sort of embedded just as being louder than somebody else, but sort of what does the data say? What does the history say? What has the research that you've gathered say? And how do you use that to inspire others, right? And I think, again, inspiration plays to the fact that for many of us, it's the person who can, you know, be a great orator, who can get people riled up. But I'm inspired by people, most often by people who I see doing work in the largest scale of what work means that is meaningful, right? Finding purpose in their work and doing something that makes the world around us, that makes our community sort of better.
I think you brought up really good points. One, of course, being empathy. I was reading an article recently about how leaders, the most important trait is empathy. Understanding people are usually coming from good intentions, right? So if they're not participating as well in the group, is it because of a variety of factors that are going against them or they're struggling with? And then you also mentioned data, right? So being able to write that compelling story, argument, and employers want to see this. How did you improve things? How many students did you work with, maybe as a teaching assistant or research assistant? How did you get through challenges? Because we don't go through any program, graduate, undergraduate, or otherwise, without hitting some challenges. And then how do you react and deal with those? Yep. And you don't have to be perfect in that, but understanding how to go about those lessons you've learned, I think, are incredibly important. And then being able to understand that the loudest voice is not always the most intelligent or specific. It's the person who just is able to shout something out quickly. So being a leader means taking into consideration all of the different things and all of the different voices that are wanting to contribute, and maybe pausing, not just going with that first idea, but taking some time to really allow everyone to contribute. And you're even maybe an informal leader when you do that, even if you don't end up being the person who does that presentation or, you know, leads the group, but you can help to pave the way and help to set the setting where the group's going to work well together and you might have a better experience.
Yeah, and I agree with all of that. And the only additional piece I would add is also owning up the fact that you don't always have the answer. Like you may have the title, but you don't always have the answer, and that you can learn through the process. I'm nearly 50 years old. I've been working in higher ed for probably half of that lifespan, and when I came here, you know, the team didn't know me. And what made it a little more challenging was my entire first year, there was about a third of the staff who I never saw in person because we were primarily remote the entirety of my first year. So I would come in and I would sort of throw an idea out and people would sort of step back and not be resistant, but try to map things out. And I finally started asking questions about like, can you talk to me about what's going on? And they're like, we never know when you walk in the room and you present an idea, if it's something we should run with or if something we should process. And I am an external processor. Like I'm an extrovert to the T. I do most of my thinking outside of my head because there's a lot of other clutter in there. And if I get it out, I once I say it, I'm like, well, does that make sense? So with the advice and guidance of my team, I now couch anything like that when I go into a room and I'll say, this is something I think we need to do. And I need a group of you to sort of step up to help make it happen. This is something I think we should do. Let's talk about it. Let's process it. Let's brainstorm on it. Let's come up with some possibilities. And this is something I just thought about. It's a half-baked idea. I thought about it on my walk to work this morning. I may forget about it by lunchtime. So that simple framing actually has helped us be more team-oriented, right? Because folks weren't chasing, you know, I always say I am a little bit like the dog in the movie Up, you know, squirrel, like I see something shiny, I get excited. So yes. Understanding that about myself, and that is actually one of my weaknesses or limitations, and building a structure around that is really helpful. And then the listening piece, right? Like I will say I am somewhat reactionary in some of my responses. And I have learned, I have not perfected this, I probably will never perfect this, learn to sort of, okay, listen, to what are people really saying? Like what is the real concern here? And sometimes being really transparent to say, I messed this up, you know? I should have approached this a different way. And when the last two jobs I've started, my first meeting with the team, I said the following thing, and I repeat this a lot. My job is to celebrate our wins and to cover for my mistakes, right? So if I believe that we should be creative and innovative, it is my job as the leader, as a leader, to provide cover for my team when we take a risk and it does not go as planned. For me, nothing we do in the career world is life or death. So risk, you know, you can mitigate as much risk as possible, but risk can also be debilitating. And if there's not a leader in the organization who says, my job is to sort of say, you all did fantastic work, this is awesome, to say, we tried this, we had good data and good background and good rationale for why, and it didn't sort of achieve what we wanted to achieve, and here's what we've learned from it. That to me, you know, it takes time for people to build that trust. But that to me is a symbol of leadership. Like I've worked for folks where I learned that from them. You know, one of my best supervisors was kind of like, just go. If it blows up, I got you covered. And I trusted her. And she, every single time we took a risk, I was less concerned about if it wasn't going to work. And it wasn't like we were just sort of doing anything. You know, there was a plan and a vision and a focus on doing it. But some things were so different than what that particular institution had done before. That level of support and cover made a huge difference for my willingness and ability to sort of say, we're gonna try something that is totally out of the box thinking for this institution. And I feel really good about the possibility of it being successful and less concerned of the possibility of it not being successful.
I think your level of self-awareness is what we all need in order to develop those skills in leadership. Because like you said, you came into a position, well, multiple times, right, where you had a team already. You didn't build the team. So they had maybe you know, a great rapport before you came in. And then you're the new person coming in as the person in charge, and they're not quite sure how to react. And so taking that time to get to know those individuals, to also frame things, as you mentioned, to kind of let them know, okay, here's just, I'm throwing it out because I externally process. And here's what I think we might want to do about that, or how we can prepare for a future discussion about it. But I wanted to get it out because in my brain, it's kind of getting mixed up with all of the other clutter. And I, as an extrovert, also agree with that and have adjusted how I communicate with my introverts. And it's kind of, it's not like you have to change who you are. It's just understanding not everybody processes and does things the same way. And so understanding that is what is going to help people gather and rally around your vision if you can help to meet them a little bit halfway. So thank you for sharing that about your, you know, beginnings of your positions, because I think a lot of people go into new jobs and they just think, I have to go in and blaze new trails and do everything and be the most. And sometimes listening and being self-aware and knowing things about yourself and identifying those to say, oh, this is how I easily process. It seems like you might do things differently. So I want to mark that down to note that so we can work really well together and know that I'm not coming in with any awful, you know, intentions or expectations, but this is how I work.
Yeah. And it's really interesting because I think in reality, the other piece, and this, I learned this from a CEO who's a Duke alum, who's been really successful, has been the CEO of some major organizations. And he, one of the things he said, and again, I think part of this is also generational. So I would say he's probably on the Gen X boomer line. Like I'm a full-fledged Gen Xer. I think the way, like I am the stereotypical Gen Xer when it comes to supervision and those things. But he said, like, you need to understand as an entry-level employee, your responsibility is the mission of the organization, right? So you actually need to understand that your mission has to be aligned if that's your job. Like, you have to understand when you're choosing where you're going to take your next job, what is the mission of that organization and how do you stay connected to that particular mission, right? Like, if you're counter to that mission, there's a lot of conflict there. So understanding what the mission and drive is and how you fit into that. And you may not know that in your first few weeks. You may not know that in your first 6 months, but sort of being able to read the room and understand. And also understand, like, you know, you walk into a different group as a student, you walk in an alum, you walk into a different group sometimes daily. And being aware and being honest, like I'll say to people, like, I've met my predecessor a few times. He is a wonderful human being. He was an exceptional advisor. People really cared about him. But I know for a fact that my style is drastically different. So I know there is an abruptness around, like, oh my God, this is so different than the way we were doing it before. And I never say that wasn't the right way to do it. I was saying, here's a different way, and here's where I've seen this way work at other institutions. Let's try it. But that self, you know, so this is a long-winded way to sort of say, self-awareness comes from the fact that I have been fortunate to have supervisors and colleagues around me who are willing to share how my style and my approach impacts other people. So you only become self-aware if you pay attention and if you have colleagues who trust you enough to say, hey, you did this. I don't think this was your intent, but here's how it landed with me, right? And that takes me time to sort of say, okay, that wasn't my intent, but I can't always manage impact, right? Because my intent may be good, but my impact may not be. And it's really be able to go back and say, look, I think I missed something here. Can we talk about how I can pay more attention to that? To me, those are the things that allow me to build rapport and relationships with people, is owning up that I don't know. And I think so much of the talk about leadership has been like, that person has to have all the answers, right? That person has to know. And I really believe a good institutional leader is somebody who surrounds themselves with people who know more than they do about particular topics. Like, I am a huge fan of our president here, Dr. Vince Price, who's a communications expert. And President Price has surrounded himself with really rock star leaders at the senior leader level here. And he listens to what they think should be done and he seeks their insight. And that makes him and it makes Duke a stronger place. So I do feel it's understanding where your sort of deficiencies are, where your weaknesses are, and where the strengths of your team is. And that's just going to, that's going to move everybody forward.
Great. So we've talked about so many different things, and I love all of this. I feel like I'm learning so much from you as well. And so one thing that's important, you know, more concrete for our graduate students is translating any on-campus experiences as leaders into industry leadership. So we obviously have a lot of students who are going for tenure track positions at R1 institutions, and we also have students who are looking to seek, you know, careers outside of the academy. And so sometimes that can be tough for understanding their experiences within higher education and then going into a for-profit corporation. So do you have any thoughts on how graduate students can translate these on-campus experiences into industry positions?
Yeah, I mean, I think everything is can be transferred if you're a good storyteller. And you were saying earlier about sort of data, and I think we were talking about storytelling almost in the same sentence. And we pulled a group of industry leaders together, including the CEO of General Motors, some leaders from LinkedIn, some leaders from Handshake. And what came out of that was the fact that they felt that every graduate, regardless of their level at the institution, should be able to understand, manipulate, and navigate data, and should be able to tell a story. So if you're a, you know, if you're a PhD student and you're teaching courses and you're teaching a course you've never taught before, you know, understanding how do you develop a syllabus, right? How do you develop lesson plans? How do you give feedback and create a rubric for that sort of feedback? That's about being a manager in an organization, right? Like, it's a project plan. How adaptable are you in those situations? How do you find the resources that help the students in that class work for it? If you're managing a lab for your PI or a research project for your PI, you're managing a team, right? Of all different types of people who are working at all different types of places. And you might be the core person to move that research, that significant research forward. So talking about, you know, if you might be managing the budget. How much is that budget? You might be working on a publication. What goes into that? How do you do your research? And it's understanding that your audience likely is going to be different than the audience you may be used to talking to, right? So you can talk in academic jargon to other academics. You can sometimes talk in academic jargon to industry folks if they're in an R&D, like in a research and development piece, right? Because that's sort of similar language. But it's understanding that people are looking for, what did you do? How did you do it? And what was the outcome from that particular piece? So if your research led to a change at the FDA or CDC, the course that you taught led to a change in the curriculum of those sorts of pieces. You know, if you're doing an internship outside of the academy, if you're doing your own research, talk me through that research in a way that's not, for lack of a better term, muddled in the language of the folks that you work with, right? I don't understand many of the things that our PhD students research, right? Because it's so niche and so narrow. I do understand how process works. So if you can be more clear about the process, like how many undergraduate and graduate students did you supervise? What went into that supervision? You know, how much did you have, were you responsible for working with, you know, working with the grants administration folks and making sure that you're reporting back to the NSF all the things that are required to keep that money flowing in that particular organization, right? If you're a master's student in a particular discipline, you know, what are your other responsibilities? What are the other things that you're doing? If it's a club or organization, right, that you're a part of, how are you sort of thinking about how that translates? And this is super old school, and I used to actually write it on a piece of paper, but sometimes I'll say to students, like, look at that job description, and on an 8.5 by 11 piece of loose leaf paper, I think they still make that, draw a line, right? Draw a line, a T down the middle of that sheet. And on one side, right, what they want, and that's in the job description. And on the other side, right, what I got, and how do I match those particular pieces? They generally don't care. Most employers, from my experience, don't care where you got the experience from. They want to show, they want you to show that you've had it and that you can translate it to them. You can't, if you're asking them to translate it, good luck, right? Because for some of these positions, there's hundreds, if not thousands of applicants. If I have to translate and make sense for myself, I'm not looking at your resume. I just don't have the time to do it. You got to show me where that translation makes effect. So I'll pick an industry, for example. So consulting, right? There is no major or discipline or course of study that makes you an ideal candidate for consulting. It is what you have done. Are you a problem solver? Are you a good researcher? Are you able to make sense of projects? Are you able to think quickly on your feet? You can do that with a PhD in STEM or an undergraduate degree in English. If you have built the requisite competencies through your time at Syracuse to actually show that you can do this, how do I make, but you have to show me that, right? You can't just write your materials and the way you're used to writing them for a particular audience. You have to be able to adapt those materials. And again, like, right, that to me is about sort of tapping into your creative muscle. You don't have to be the most creative person, but how do I tell this story in a way that may make sense? One of my favorite things I've seen at a couple institutions is having PhD students pitch their research in 3 minutes to an audience of folks who are not from their discipline. It's such great skill set to be able to do that, right? Like, it's so amazing. And you find people who are actually kind of interested in what you're doing because they don't have to understand all the scientific or jargon that sometimes people are using.
Yeah, absolutely. We have the 3-minute thesis competition here. And I think that is the disconnect a lot of times with those industry employers, and especially with PhD students. It seems like there's this huge disconnect. And when I worked as a recruiter, we would have some PhDs apply to opportunities, and they didn't require PhDs, but they could have a PhD. And we would have a lot of trouble understanding what was their work. And so that goes for everybody, not just a PhD, but I think there is that larger disconnect sometimes of understanding how it translates. And getting a PhD gives you so many transferable skills. And that's where coming into the career office here at the graduate school, we can help you understand how the industry wants that. And so I do a similar thing as you, Greg, instead of that loose leaf paper, which they do still make, that, you know, highlighting, even in Google Docs, highlighting all the skills that you have that they want on the, you know, job description or internship description, going through your resume, focusing on the cover letter, talking about what you have that they want, and almost thinking of a Venn diagram.
Yeah.
One circle being you, one circle being the job, and how much can you show them that you overlap? You want to get as close to, you know, 100% as possible, but of course you should apply for jobs where it's not 100% because you never know who else is applying.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So really great to hear all of those tips and pieces of advice, because students, I think, sometimes get lost thinking, oh, I've set myself up for this, or when I started my PhD 5, 7, 3 years ago, I thought I was going to go in this path, and look at how the world has changed. Even without the pandemic, the world keeps changing while you're in programs. And now you may, life circumstances may now have you pivoting into a different direction or desiring a different direction. And so being able to translate that and tell your story is so important. So thank you for sharing all of those tips and advice. Do you have any other last minute things you wanted to mention today?
So this is not sort of in leadership, but it's something I've been talking about a lot lately. I think there's this really almost overwhelming feeling that you have to have your career figured out before you graduate from whatever program you're in, right? That you have to know what you want to do for the rest of your working life. And for many students, current students, that might be, depending upon when you started your graduate degree, that might be 50 more years of work. And I like to say to students, your career is what you look back upon the day you retire, right? You're out to get the next experience in this particular journey that we call career. And that a job really is a bundling of skills and competencies and how you've applied those. So you can have goals and look ahead of here's where I think I'd like to be, but you're not really sort of focusing on this is what my career is going to be. Because we know that the world of work changes so drastically. You know, I was having a conversation a couple of days ago with somebody that say, 7 or 8 years ago, nobody knew what a UI UX researcher was. Right. Like, right. And those jobs are, you know, UI, UX designer are everywhere, right? Social media was a tiny part of somebody's job. It was not a full-time job, right? That those things did not exist. AI was, you know, this is going to sound rude, but was a bunch of nerds in a corner in a dark building doing this. And now it's everywhere, right? Data scientists, data analytics. It was a small subset. Every industry is hiring people who are data scientists and data analytics. So the jobs of the future have not even launched yet. So really thinking about, as I think about my experience as a graduate student at Syracuse, what are the bundling of skills I have? And when I go to this next job, how do I add to that bundle? You know, how do I add to that toolkit that helps me think about what's next, right? So it's also building those skills, but it's also understanding, how do I get closer to something? Like, we learn something. You have an internship, you have an experience, and you're like, I want less of this and more of this. And that's really what your career is about. You know, for many folks, they're not going to stay in the same industry. They're going to switch industries. They're going to have a multitude of pathways. You know, we talk a lot with alums who are probably now around my age about encore careers, right? That they're switching. Somebody who spent 25 years in finance, really wanted to be a math teacher and is going back to be able to do that. But I think for so many folks, there's this pressure of I have to have my career figured out. And I want people to realize it's the next step in the journey, right? And you may take that step and realize it's not the right fit. And that's okay, right? You've realized that now. It's better than to do it for 20 years and be like, what the heck am I doing, right? Mm-hmm. So I always say to students, like, don't put that pressure on you. You have to figure out what your career is. Figure out what's the next step in the journey. And from that, then you sort of say, okay, this is stackable. I'm going to learn something from here. Where do I go next? And sometimes it's even going into LinkedIn and looking at somebody who's kind of got the job you think someday you might want to have and backing through, you know, how did they get there? And you'll often see it's not a linear path, right? You know, they worked in a completely different industry and maybe had a connection with somebody or showed leadership potential. And somebody said, I'm going to take you with me, right? Like, I value what you bring. I'm leaving this organization. I'm taking you with me. So don't stress yourself out about that. I think it's just building blocks of experiences. That's what got you to where you are now. It's those building blocks moving forward. I think that'll lead you to more success and happiness and less often do unneeded stress.
Yeah, I think it's absolutely easier said than done, but such a good reminder that you don't at any point in life have to have everything figured out. It's just what's the next thing or how can I make the current thing, you know, even better? And I think too, when you know, students graduate from programs, they think, okay, I graduated. Now this magical wisdom is going to, you know, come to me and I'll have everything figured out. Or once I hit this age, I'm going to have everything figured out. And it's just not the case. But hopefully you can surround yourself with great people throughout your programs and then throughout your career that can help you with their honesty, with reflection from them and from yourself in order to keep building and growing in the directions that you want to. And if not, skills are very transferable. Yep. There's other directions that you can pivot to. And so you've mentioned so many great things today. I feel very inspired and I'm sure many others will be inspired as well. And I just want to thank you for chatting with us from much more warmer North Carolina in Syracuse. It's currently a decent amount of snow on the ground. So we'll send you a little bit of snow your way maybe in the future.
You can keep it. But okay. Tracy, thanks thanks so much for having me. It's been a pleasure, catching up with you and talking about a topic that I think is really important as we think about the current state of the world and how are we sort of amplifying folks who we really believe are leaders and are who are going to make our communities, and those can be small communities, you know, small enough communities, a lab, or our roommates, to, you know, the world a better place based upon their ability to inspire those around them.
Great. Thank you so much. Mm-hmm.